a mysterious ancient script undeciphered for more than 3,000 years.
So Linear B was this kind of locked room mystery, and it became one of the greatest intellectual puzzles of the modern age.
That's Marguerite Fox. She tells us the fascinating story of how the Minoan script Linear B got cracked, and the forgotten female professor from Brooklyn College, without whom it would never have been done. Her book is The Riddle of the Labyrinth, The Quest to Crack an Ancient Code. Then we air our 2009 interview with Anne Heller about her biography of Ayn Rand. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Many young women alive today don't realize how difficult it was, until recently, for women to get credit for the discoveries they made. For example, without scientist Rosalind Franklin, Francis Crick and James Watson would probably never have been able to crack the code of DNA or win the Nobel Prize for it. Yet, have you ever heard of Rosalind Franklin? Nor most likely have you heard of Alice Kober. But she laid the foundation for cracking another code, deciphering the ancient Minoan script, Linear B. Two men, Arthur Evans and Michael Ventris, get the credit for that. Evans because he started the work at the turn of the 20th century, and Ventris because some 50 years later, finished it. But without Alice Kober in between, the almost impossible task of cracking Linear B would likely never have happened. Kober, the daughter of Jewish immigrants, grew up in New York City and became a classics professor at Brooklyn College. Deciphering Linear B was her single-minded passion, an intellectual puzzle par excellence, because it meant making sense of the unknown writing of a completely forgotten language. In her book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth, Marguerite Fox says Kober deserves much of the credit for one of the most prodigious intellectual feats of modern times. But Kober was forgotten after her untimely death in 1950. Fox, who was an obituary writer for the New York Times, also has a background in linguistics. Both stand her in good stead as she leads the reader through an understanding of code cracking and linguistics, and as she rescues Alice Kober from posthumous obscurity. Marguerite Fox, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much.
This just was a fascinating book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth. It's the quest to crack an ancient code. You tell the story of the code of Minoan Linear B script. And you say that there is a huge piece of the story that has gone largely unknown, and that is the role of Alice Elizabeth Kober. I'd like to focus in many ways on her in this interview, but I'd like to round out the story as well. First of all, tell us, what is Minoan Linear B script?
Excellent question. And that, of course, is the central question of the book, because no one knew what it was. In the spring of 1900, on a spring day much like this one, the great English archaeologist Arthur Evans was excavating on Crete at Knossos, and he excavated the ruins of a lavish, sprawling Bronze Age palace, bigger than Buckingham Palace, and he could tell, even though everything had fallen to ruin, that it had had labyrinthine rooms, beautiful painted murals, bubbling fountains, all of that. All of those amazing discoveries paled beside what he found 1 week into the dig, which was a room that was a treasure trove of clay tablets inscribed with this bewildering set of characters that looked like no writing ever seen. They had been set down in wet clay by palace scribes in about 1450 BC, right in the middle of the Aegean Bronze Age. And Evans named the script Linear B because it was made with linear strokes rather than the wedge-shaped impressions that cuneiform was made with. And more than 50 years, try though they might, scholars and would-be decipherers around the world tried to unravel Linear B. Not only did nobody know what these mysterious tablets said, no one even knew what language Linear B recorded. There were many languages spoken in the Bronze Age Aegean back then, and it could have been any one of them or even a language that nobody knew about by the 20th century. So Linear B was this kind of locked room mystery, and it became one of the greatest intellectual puzzles of the modern age.
And you speak in the book, Marguerite Fox, in The Riddle of the Labyrinth, you talk about, for example, the Rosetta Stone, which also was an unknown script. Well, there had been an unknown script, but it provided the key. What was the key difference in the Rosetta Stone?
The key difference was that it existed at all. The Rosetta Stone was a bilingual inscription, which is something that is the most coveted prize in archaeological decipherment. The Rosetta Stone, which was found during the Napoleonic Wars at the very end of the 1700s, was inscribed in ancient Greek, which of course was a language that scholars could still understand very well, ancient Greek on one part of it, and Egyptian hieroglyphics on the other part. And so, presto, with that discovery, people were able to work out one of the other great archaeological decipherments of modern times, the decipherment of the Egyptian hieroglyphs, because the Rosetta Stone gave them a known text to read the hieroglyphs against. And pine though they might for something similar to surface that would be inscribed in Linear B and the script of some known language, no such bilingual inscription for Linear B ever surfaced, nor has one surfaced to this day. And so that's why I think of it as a kind of locked room mystery. It was a totally closed system, an unknown script writing an unknown language. So if you are a would-be decipherer, how do you ever find your way into a system like that?
And that is, of course, a central question. I mean, it's a fascinating story that you tell in The Riddle of the Labyrinth, how that came about. But you also start out by giving the reader an understanding of kind of the basis of the different kinds of scripts that there are. And this was also a mystery. A lot of people originally thought that it was, or some people thought that the Minoan script was a pictographic or a kind of hieroglyphic language, but it wasn't. Explain the difference, and how did it get figured out that it wasn't a pictographic language?
Right. All of the writing systems in the world for whatever language, in whatever country, whatever kind of graphic style the script can assume, all of the writing systems of the world are one of only three types, or perhaps a combination of one of the three. And the three types are these. There are logographic systems, and the best one known today is Chinese, where each word of the language is represented by a separate character of the script. The next one is syllabic writing, which modern Japanese employs, where each character of the script stands for a syllable, like ma or pa or ta. And the third one is, of course, one that we English speakers know like the back of our hand, and that is an alphabet. And so if you are an archaeologist and you've dug up some kind of bewildering script scratched on clay tablets, one of your first orders of business is to determine which of these three types of scripts they are. Because without knowing that, you can't even get a toe in the door of this locked room that decipherment represents. And indeed, many people in the early days of the Linear B discovery were misled by the fact that a lot of characters in the Linear B script look like little pictures of things that we know. There are little pictures of horses' heads, little pictures of swords, chariots, things that look like philodendron leaves and shirt buttons, all kinds of stuff. So it's, of course, a very seductive mistake to make to assume, aha, it's a hieroglyphic system, or as a linguist would say, a logographic system, where each little picture stands for the word for the corresponding object. in fact, that turned out not to be the case. And it was recognized pretty quickly, including by Sir Arthur Evans, the archaeologist who first dug up the tablets, that Linear B, in fact, was a syllabic script with each character. There were about 80 to 85 characters in the script, each character standing for a syllable. And there's a relatively simple test to determine what kind of script you have, and that is you start counting. You count the characters. And if you have thousands or tens of thousands of characters, then, of course, you're looking at a logographic system like Chinese. And the reason there are so many is every word has its own character. A smaller number, maybe 80 to 200, you have a syllabic system, which is what we had with Linear B. And if you have a still smaller number, only a couple of dozen characters, then, of course, you're looking at an alphabet. And our Roman alphabet with 26 characters falls squarely within that frame. So Linear B was, in fact, not logographic. Despite the presence of all these sweet little pictures, it was a syllabic writing system.
And then about the language, how did it get figured? What language, in fact, was it related to? I mean, we're talking about the Cretans, the ancient Cretans now. What language was it related to, and how was that figured out?
Well, nobody knew for the longest time. And, of course, many investigators persisted in the foolhardy approach of looking at Linear B through the wrong end of the telescope, where they responded unwisely to the great temptation to try to put your finger on the language first and then consciously or unconsciously make the data come out so that it fits your hypothesis. And people had reasonable assumptions, languages that would have been spoken in the Bronze Age Aegean. Ancient Etruscan was one of them, which was a non-Indo-European language of ancient Italy. People had really wacky assumptions. There were people who thought it was a form of Polynesian, people who thought it was Basque, people who thought it was a form of Celtic spoken by the Celts on their way to Ireland. There were ancient scripts tend to bring out a lot of crackpot theories in the more frivolous investigators. They have that effect on people. What Linear B actually was not known for 52 years. The tablets were dug up in 1900. Arthur Evans died in 1941 without having fulfilled his great dream of deciphering the script. Then suddenly, in 1952, Linear B was deciphered seemingly in a single stroke of blind inspiration, not by a scholar, not by an archaeologist, but by an impassioned amateur, a very young man, he was not yet 30, an Englishman named Michael Ventris. He was by profession an architect, but he was one of those people that has a native genius for picking up languages, and he had been fascinated to the point of obsession with ancient scripts in general, and with Linear B in particular, from the time he was a schoolboy. And as he correctly determined, Linear B turned out to write a very, very early dialect of ancient Greek, spoken 500 years before Homer's time and a full 1,000 years before the glories of the Greek classical age, and written down in this strange script that invading Greeks had picked up from the indigenous Minoan Cretans, written down centuries before the advent of the Greek alphabet, when no one could have conceived there were Greek speakers in the region, much less Greek speakers with any way of writing their language down.
Wow, this is fascinating. We're talking with Margalit Fox about her new book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth, The Quest to Crack an Ancient Code. So this took around 50 years to decipher. And as you said before, the clue word, I think, was seemingly deciphered at one stroke. But there was actually, Michael Ventris had some giant's shoulders to stand on. One in particular, a woman, Alice Elizabeth Kober. Tell us about her.
That's right. And the story, since history is always written by the victors, the story of Linear B has long and quite rightly been this British triumphal narrative. Michael Ventris was celebrated. He became world famous practically overnight. And the story takes on added poignancy because he was killed in 1956, just 4 years after he cracked the code. He was killed at the age of 34 in a swift, sudden, and still unexplained accident that may well have been suicide. So it's a very dramatic, very resonant story, but it turns out not to be the whole story. And the great missing piece was supplied right here in America by Alice Kober, who was an overworked, underpaid professor of classics at Brooklyn College here in New York City. And Alice never married, apparently never had a romantic partner of any kind. She lived kind of the classic life of the spinster schoolmarm from Central Casting at mid-century. She lived in the Flatbush section of Brooklyn in a house she owned with her widowed mother. And night after night, after her crushing load of undergraduate classes was taught and her dozens and dozens, sometimes hundreds of papers were graded, she sat at her dining table in Brooklyn and devoted herself to what she believed was the true mission of her life, deciphering Linear B. And she came within a hair's breadth of doing it before her own very early death in 1950, just 2 years before Ventris solved the riddle. And Alice Kober was only 43 when she died. So the kind of tragic thing about Linear B is everyone who seems to touch it with this high degree of brilliance dies young, unhappily. But what Alice Kober did, working on her own time for very little recognition and heaven knows for no recompense, was to set forth methodologies by which decipherers could finesse their way into this closed system of an unknown language writing an unknown script. People, including Michael Ventris, had been scrambling to do it in all the wrong ways. Michael Ventris himself first imputed a language to Linear B. He firmly believed until weeks before the decipherment that it wrote ancient Etruscan, and so that got him off onto the wrong track right away. Alice Kober remained resolutely agnostic on the language the scripts wrote or on what sounds any character of the script stood for. To the end of her life, she famously said, "I am only interested in what the Minoans wrote." And so it was she who, through her few published papers in her lifetime, developed what she called a science of graphics and really taught the analysts who came after her, notably Michael Ventris, how to look for hidden but repeated patterns of repeated configurations of symbols within an unknown script and how to use your analysis of those patterns to home in on what kind of language the script could possibly be used to write.
Well, explain this a little further. What you describe sounds a lot like deciphering code, but in deciphering code, the coders know the language that they're deciphering the code of. Explain this. How does one, in fact, go at deciphering a language? I almost feel like not from a linguistic way, not from a way of meaning, but from a way of patterns. This is difficult to wrap the mind around.
You put your finger right on it, in fact, and one of the wonderful things I found in Alice Kober's papers, because by happy coincidence, right before I started work on this book, I had known I'd wanted to write a book on Linear B, and as everyone did, knew the Michael Ventris story, but nothing else. By happy coincidence, an archive of Kober's papers, the mountains of correspondence and all of her notebooks and file cards in which she analyzed Linear B, was opened at the University of Texas right at the time I started my work. So I had the great privilege of being the first researcher to get full access to her papers, and that revealed her extraordinary, pivotal pivotal, indispensable role in the decipherment, which has long gone unacknowledged. One of the wonderful things in among her papers was the typescript of a talk she gave, I believe, at Yale. The title of the talk was Form Without Meaning, and it was Alice Kober who really set forth canonically the fact that the only way to approach the decipherment of an unknown language written in an unknown script is to be willing to immerse yourself in this world with form about meaning. And just as you said, you have to look at the symbols purely as graphic pieces. You have to almost divorce them from language at the start. And all you are doing, much as the decipherer of a wartime code is doing, is you are looking for patterns in the symbols. In Alice Kober's case, she was able to prove that certain repeated configurations of symbols that came up again and again and again at the ends of the words of Linear B represented word endings, what we would call suffixes, the kind of suffixes you might see on nouns and adjectives in Spanish or in German, in Latin, or, as it happens, in ancient Greek. And so she was making really, really splendid progress, starting to home in on the kind of language that Linear B wrote, because not all of the languages of the world use suffixes. So she was able to eliminate a whole class of languages right there. And it's pretty clear now to historians of the decipherments, and pretty clear to me, that had Alice Kober not died in 1950, she almost certainly would have solved the riddle of Linear B. And it's also abundantly clear that had it not been for her work, Michael Ventris never would have cracked the code when he did, if ever.
And so she would have, in other words, the form would have led to the meaning at some point. And there was one word that she deciphered the meaning of. It was, or somebody did, I'm not quite sure if it was her at this point, and that was the word total. How did they come up with an understanding of that word?
Right. The word total is interesting, and that was known even before Alice Kober. It was known from the beginning, and it's a case study of the fact that in deciphering an unknown script, you also have to look for the context in which these words are used, even though you have no idea what the word is. And one of the things that was recognized right away, including by Arthur Evans, the first discoverer of the tablets, was the tablets were basically the account books of these Bronze Age palaces. They were written down by palace scribes, and you could tell from, there were some transparent pictograms on the tablets, and so you could tell it was records of grain and cattle and sheep. It was the records of the buying and selling and the movement of crops and all of the things that were important in the economy of this agricultural society. And very, very often the tablets would contain mathematical tallies, and the numbers were able to be read almost immediately. They were not that different from the way we make little tick marks to show, you know, 1, 2, 3 when we're jotting down in numbers in shorthand. And at the bottom of each of these tallies would be the total, which could be read, preceded by two signs. And so it was very clear from context that just the way we might write in an account book ledger, the sum preceded by the word total with this two-sign word, whatever it was, the Minoan scribes were likewise saying, here's the total. So that word was known, but in almost 50 years, that was pretty much the only word on the tablets that was known.
Well, hear, hear for the bean counters.
Exactly. That's what it was. This was Bronze Age bean counting at its finest.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Marguerite Fox about her book, Riddle of the Labyrinth. Now, another reason that Alice Kober's role has been obscured, I think you imply pretty clearly in the book, is because she was a woman in mid-century America. She almost got a teaching post at Penn State, a post for which she was probably the most qualified person in the world because it was linked to deciphering this Minoan script and teaching of the classics, a foundation, a center for Minoan linguistic research, a position there. What happened?
Mike, an awful lot of women's lives before the women's movement. Alice Kober's life was one that in which a brilliant mind and brilliant achievements were unfortunately more than counterbalanced by disappointment. And you're right, she wasn't taken seriously because she was a woman. Archaeology and archaeological decipherment historically was a man's game. If you think about who are the people who have the resources to travel halfway across the world, bring a whole team, bring all this equipment, spend, you know, 4 decades digging up and restoring a magnificent palace, as Arthur Evans did, historically those people were European men with a great deal of personal money. And Alice Kober was the scrappy, working-class daughter of Hungarian immigrants to New York, educated in the city's public school system, brilliant student. So she was at a disadvantage just in terms of the resources that were available to her and the seriousness with which she was taken because she was a woman. She was one of the great disappointments of her life that is amply and painfully documented in her correspondence is she was on the short list for a very, very prestigious job at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which would have freed her from the drudgery she was required to do at Brooklyn College of teaching, you know, 5 101 level classes to undergraduates a semester and, you know, lugging home 150 papers at a time to grade. It would have been attached to a Center for Minoan Linguistic Research, which she would be allowed to establish and run. And so for the first time in her life, her deep, coveted ambition of spending her life working on Linear B without doing all the other stuff would have come to pass. And sadly, in the end, although she was apparently second on everyone's list, they chose a man. He, you know, he was a very eminent linguist and certainly qualified, but that was one of the many great disappointments of her life. And shortly after that, she became very ill and died at the age of 43.
Right. And we don't even know what she died of, although you speculate that it was cancer. You are one of the people who writes the obituaries, and frankly, I think yours are the best, in the New York Times. It must have been very frustrating for you to not know what she died from. And also you say that writing this book, in which she figures so prominently, is in some way the discharging of a debt related to your work for the Times. Tell us about all that.
That's right. We know that Alice Kober died at the age of 43 in May 1950. Unfortunately for me, although I can obtain a copy of her death certificate, the cause of death is routinely redacted from New York City death certificates of that period. One has to prove that one is the most immediate kind of immediate family, and of course I was never able to do that. The fact that I was her biographer wasn't enough. Alice Kober does, she never married, so had no kids, but she does have a much younger cousin who is a lovely woman now in her 70s who lives in Texas, who herself tried to obtain a proper copy of the death certificate as a relative, and apparently she wasn't considered a close enough relative, so even between the two of us, we were never able to do it. We know from Kober's letters that she was a chain smoker, and we also know one of the really fascinating things in her archive that shows how hard she works are the collections of hand-cut index cards that she made on which she analyzed every word and every character of Linear B. And the reason they were handmade was her work was done principally in the 1940s and during World War II and afterwards. Paper was a very scarce commodity, so you couldn't just go to a stationer and buy index cards. So she would cut by hand 2x3-inch slips of paper from the backs of old greeting cards, from flyers, from church circulars. She stole a lot of checkout slips from the library at Brooklyn College and would make cards out of the backs of those. And she stored her ersatz index cards in file boxes made from old cigarette cartons, which was clearly the one paper product that she had in no short supply. And her much younger cousin told me in an interview that it was whispered among the women in the family that Aunt Alice had some sort of rare form of stomach cancer. So it was almost certainly cancer that killed her. We just don't know specifically what kind.
And the discharging of a debt?
Yes, indeed. I am by day. I'm a senior writer at the New York Times in the obituary news department, where my job and my colleague's job is to recreate a life from the past every day. And when Alice Cooper died in 1950, the Times did indeed run a short news obit, and it was kind of a victim of its times. News obits in those years and until maybe the last 10 or 15 years were frankly rather dull, dutiful documents where they basically listed where you got your degrees and what clubs you belong to and what job titles you've held. And Cooper's obit in our pages was no different. And so one of the things about my book, The Riddle of the Labyrinth, that I have found very stimulating and very moving is the chance not only to tell the story of this really thrilling intellectual detective work that was The Decipherment of Linear B, but also the chance to bring to light this long-forgotten piece of women's history in terms of recording Alice Cooper's contribution to the decipherment.
Marguerite Fox. Her book is The Riddle of the Labyrinth, The Quest to Crack an Ancient Code. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next, we revisit the biography of another brilliant Jewish woman of the 20th century, Ayn Rand. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Unlike Alice Cooper, who was born in New York of Jewish immigrant parents, Ayn Rand came to the U.S. as an adult, having grown up in Russia in a Jewish family devastated by the Russian Revolution. We spoke to Ann C. Heller in 2009 about her fascinating biography, Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Although Ayn Rand has been dead for almost 30 years, her books are still phenomenal bestsellers. The two most famous, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead, have sold more than 12 million copies in the U.S. alone. She's the object of adulation by conservatives for her advocacy of limited government and free market capitalism. The reaction to her by progressives has been equally fierce repulsion against her elevation of selfishness to the highest good. Rand was a brilliant writer, but English wasn't her native tongue. She was born Alyssa Rosenbaum, a Russian Jew, who fled her native land after the Revolution of 1917. Plain-looking, even slovenly, Rand carried on a long-time affair with her disciple Nathaniel Brandon, while married all her life to another man with matinee idol looks. She was charismatic, controversial, idiosyncratic, and egomaniacal. Ayn Rand is a biographer's dream, and Ann C. Heller is wonderfully suited to the job. She doesn't agree with Ayn Rand's philosophy, but has been fascinated by her since working as an executive editor at Condé Nast Publications, with a special emphasis on money and finance. Heller's book is Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Ann Heller, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, in your biography of Ayn Rand, and I have to say first, I never thought that I would want to read a biography of Ayn Rand, but I loved it.
Thank you.
It's wonderful.
I never thought I'd want to write one.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. You make it clear from the beginning that you don't share Ayn Rand's moral philosophy, but you became fascinated. I mean, could we even say obsessed with her?
Well, I certainly spent five and a half years in daily contact with her. And so I think you could say deeply engaged, if not obsessed. And, it wasn't her philosophy so much as her drive and her, there were so many mysterious things about her to me once I had read her books and read a little bit about her, that it was a bit like the pursuit of a detective story for me, to find out who she was and why she did what she did.
What kinds of mysterious things?
She was somebody who liked to erase the remnants of her past. She didn't tell many people anything about her family. She was born in Russia in 1905, and the people close to her knew that because she had a thick Russian accent. And she told people about having lived through the Russian Revolution when she was 12. But beyond that, people didn't know very much about her. In fact, when she died, nobody knew that her real name had been Alyssa Rosenbaum, nor that she had any living relatives in the United States, although she did. The people who she'd come to stay with in her first year in the U.S. many of them were still alive, but nobody knew they existed. So she kept her personal life and her background a mystery and claimed that her philosophy and her literary inspiration came out of nowhere and descended upon her. She talked about herself as a self-created soul, and my experience with human beings told me that there was more to it than that, and I wanted to find out what it was.
In the book, one of her friends, her copy editor for Atlas Shrugged, is that right?
Yes.
She said that Rand became a slave to the image she built.
Isn't that a poignant comment?
Yeah, what do you think she meant by that?
After she finished The Fountainhead and as she was writing Atlas Shrugged, she became more and more, I think, invested in seeing herself as like her characters, as heroic, as so rational as to be somebody who couldn't make mistakes. And therefore, she put herself out on a thinner and thinner limb in some respects. And
a slave to that, how did that cost her?
What most people know about Ayn Rand is that her novels of the 1940s and 50s brought her a cult following in the late 1950s and 60s of young people who just worshipped her point of view and her certainty that she could answer every question about political and moral life with a finality that few people thought they had. And she was unable at that point to be challenged or to admit mistakes, if she even thought that she made mistakes. And I don't think she admitted mistakes even to herself. And her followers to this day, and she has many almost fundamentalist followers who believe every word she said and don't believe anything that she didn't herself say, would say that she was infallible and that after you read Ayn Rand, nothing needs to be said and that no questions need to be answered. So she put herself in a precarious position from the point of view of a regular human being like the rest of us, making herself infallible.
And you write on the very first page of the book, Ayn Rand and the World She Made, that Rand's world was one in which no dictator, no deity, and no well-meaning sense of duty would ever take away the moral right of the gifted individual, Ayn Rand, to live according to her own high wattage lights. Why did you insert her name into that sentence? Why did you particularize it to her? Did she not give the same privileges to other gifted individuals?
I think she did, although to my knowledge, she never found anybody who measured up in real life to her estimation of her character's attainments and to her estimation of her own. But apart from that, I wanted to emphasize my finding that Her philosophy grew up in reaction to some very personal events and perceptions and feelings about herself in the world in which she was a child and a young adult. And that her, to some degree, her philosophy explained herself to herself.
And you have, it's just a fascinating treatment of her childhood. Take us back to the beginning. Tell us about her family. Tell us about the life they lived before the revolution and then what they underwent during it.
She was born in 1905 in St. Petersburg. Her family was Jewish. And that was a period of a remarkable political and ethnic strife in Russia, which ended in the 1917 revolution, but that built up to that revolution for a long time. Her family was upwardly mobile. I think her father had been born poor from everything I'd been able to find out about him. Her mother was an upper-middle-class Jewish woman, and together they built a life that was the life of a prosperous small business men's family. And she was just 12 years old when the Russian Revolution took place, and her father's store was taken away from him, and their wealth was taken from them, and they were left more or less penniless and propertyless in St. Petersburg. She saw this as a grave injustice, and she was deeply affected by the idea that anybody could take away something that somebody had worked so hard to earn, as she thought her father had worked to earn his store and his livelihood. They left St. Petersburg for the Crimea, which was still not under Red control, not under Lenin's control. But soon the Crimea was conquered, and they had to come back to St. Petersburg. And she went to school, to college there, and she lived there until she was 21. And it was clear to her family and to herself that she would not survive if she stayed there, because she just couldn't keep her opinions to herself, as everybody who knew her in the United States also found out. So her family managed to get her out of Russia, just as the opportunity to leave Russia was closing up in 1926. She came to America and started what, you know, is a more or less a fairy tale life. She went to California. She went to Chicago and stayed with relatives for a while, learned a little bit of English, not much, went to Hollywood and immediately got a job with Cecil B. DeMille, first as a walk-on extra in his silent movie King of Kings, and then as a junior script writer for silent movies, writing dialogue boxes.
That's phenomenal, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's amazing, and many of her friends suspect that it didn't happen just coincidentally, that she spent some time stalking Cecil B. DeMille and possibly his wife as well in order to be introduced to him.
To go back just a little bit, in terms of her character, she was a brilliant child, but she was also a bit of an outsider, wasn't she?
Very lonely, was aware that there was something socially wrong with her, as she put it, that she was too intense, too violent in her likes and dislikes, too serious for most children and most adults. She had no outside friends. She had a bunch of cousins, aunts and uncles around her, and even those people she wasn't entirely comfortable with. And her mother, who was quite a conventional woman as far as I'm able to tell, urged her to play more with children, to get out more, to be friendlier, to be more popular, to dress more carefully. She never cared about how she looked. And none of that advice took with Ayn Rand.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking about Ayn Rand with biographer Anne C. Heller. Her book is Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Now, back to Hollywood. I mean, she, not only does she come here, she doesn't know English. She learns English, and she becomes a script writer for some of the biggest Hollywood studios. Talk a little bit about her life in Hollywood and how others saw her and how she kind of inserted herself into that life, and also the kinds of scripts that she wanted to write.
Well, when she arrived in Hollywood in 1926, it was still, a pioneering town in the middle of Orange Groves in California. She left there in the late 20s to go to New York to produce her first play on Broadway, which was called The Night of January 16th, and was eventually bought as a property for movie studios in Hollywood. She went back to Hollywood in the middle 40s when Paramount bought the rights to The Fountainhead. I hope I'm right about that. No, it was Warner Brothers, excuse me, who bought the rights to The Fountainhead. And she went on to work with Hal Wallace and Paramount and other movie producers on other scripts besides that of The Fountainhead. And she was quite a celebrated person in Hollywood at that time. Hal Wallace was at the top of his game, and she was glamorous looking at that point. She'd made some money. She had a house in the San Fernando Valley. Hollywood in those days was still very much a left-leaning town, as it may still be today. I'm not sure about that. It was a communist town. At least the guilds and the unions were communist, and this horrified Ayn Rand. So she was very active in the 40s in Hollywood in opposing communism and helping to found organizations that fought the communist unions and the communist guilds. And in fact, one organization that she was a member of organized to help the House Un-American Activities Committee in its hearings about Hollywood in 1947, at which she testified. She spent a couple more years in Hollywood after that, and then she followed her young lover, not at that point her lover, but her young acolyte from Hollywood to New York, and she lived in New York for the rest of her life while she wrote Atlas Shrugged and became a cult figure there.
Yeah, and those hearings in 1947, was that before the McCarthy? That was the McCarthy period, right?
It was just before the McCarthy period, before McCarthy, you know, took charge of his own committee, okay. A few years before that.
That's when there were some really great Hollywood people who got blacklisted for a very long time.
It was exactly those hearings at which she testified. She did not name names in her testimony. In fact, she was kind of a dupe of the committee in some respects. She was the only Russian to testify, and she was used to indict some of the studios without really her. She's a bit naive about it, and it was not with her voluntary assent that she was made to do that. She wanted to point out that Hollywood misrepresented Russia and communism in its movies, in its romanticization of cheerful collectivized farmers, you know, singing songs in the fields and so on. But she was thought to be a namer of names. She still is, I think. Anyone who testified in those hearings at which the Hollywood Ten were indicted for perjury and sent to jail is thought to have done a very bad thing.
Now, you mentioned her soon-to-be lover, Nathaniel Brandon, who's her acolyte. Now, she was married at this time, married all her life to the same man. Is that right?
She married a gentle, elegant, handsome, uneducated man named Frank O'Connor in 1929. She met him her first day working for Cecil B. DeMille on King of Kings, which would be about her third or fourth day in Hollywood. And he was her ideal man from her first glimpse of him. And when she was having a hard time meeting him, she walked over to him after a scene, in a break between scenes, and stuck out her foot and tripped him, at which he apologized to her. And later on, they kept company, and then when her visa was running out, he married her. And they stayed together for 50 years. And in 1954 and 1955, when she was beginning her affair with Nathaniel Brandon, she was 45 and he was 21.
He was pretty young.
He was pretty young. He was 25 years younger than she was. She was so persuasive that she was able to convince her husband, for whom this kind of open marriage would not be naturally agreeable, and the wife of her young lover to agree to let them have a love affair and to keep silent about it for the rest of their lives. She promised that it would go on only for a year or two. She recognized, she said, that she was too old to keep this going for very long, but that it was her last chance at a real kind of sexual happiness with someone who was her intellectual equal. And she needed this, and they assented. It went on for the next 14 years. and it ended explosively in 1968.
What does that tell you about Ayn Rand and her moral universe?
Her moral universe was complicated. She was, interestingly enough, all her characters, her female characters in her books, have affairs with more than one man. She had no moral problem with serial love affairs. Nobody in her books has a love affair with two men at the same time, but she was Russian in the sense that sexual freedom came naturally to her morally. So she found nothing wrong with that aspect of it, and she felt that she'd been entirely honest and just in consulting her husband and her lover's wife before they started their affair. So she had no problem with herself at all.
Yeah.
But what she didn't take into account, of course, is how damaging, even with their agreement, how damaging to the spouses and in the end to herself and Nathaniel such an affair would be, because it had to be kept secret from the world, because in spite of the fact that she thought that they were all above feeling jealousy, they were not. And they and others were very much harmed by the insularity, the possessiveness, the secretiveness of the whole affair.
Right. And we're speaking with Anne Heller. She is the author of a terrific biography of Ayn Rand, Ayn Rand and the World She Made. Now to The Fountainhead, which really put her on the map. It has as its main character the architect Howard Roark, and he gives a famous 8-page speech in which you write that you say it can be summed up as a passionate plea for egoism, which isn't surprising given what you've already told us about Ayn Rand. She says that anything that proceeds from man's independent ego is good, in the words of her character. You know, as I said in the beginning, I never thought I'd be interested in reading a book about her, but I also never thought I would find myself in agreement with her to some degree, and that is in the sense of, and I think she went way too far, but in the sense of the need to balance, at least, the needs of the individual and the needs of the collective. And I think she really, she was strong on the needs of the individual, not at all on the collective. I'd like to ask you, where do you find yourself in having been immersed in her life? You know, it seems to me this is the great contradiction between the needs of others and the needs of oneself.
It's a argument, it's a conversation that never goes away, does it? She defines the one extreme of the argument so well that one can't help but find oneself butting up against it and trying to, like, she's got to be wrong, but where is she wrong? How can I get beneath this argument and define my own feeling about all of this? I agree with you that that I, too, found myself surprisingly in agreement with her about, at least, she said that altruism, which she deplored and which she identified with both communism and Christianity, particularly Russian Orthodox Christianity, as caring more about others than one cares about oneself. In other words, putting others' welfare before one's own welfare. And many of us who are raised with a real focus on the social contract and the needs of other people kind of unconsciously do that, but it was very interesting to think that dichotomy out while I was writing about her. And it was one of the reasons why I wanted to write about her. I wanted to think through some of her ideas. I must say, I haven't solved the problem, even for myself, but I do agree with you, too, that she is way, way too far out there. She ignores the social contract that we have with each other. The real selfish need we have for all of us to be on some sort of equal playing field so that we have a society that functions and functions happily and healthily. I often thought while writing the book, why, when she was so much against Franklin Delano Roosevelt's policies, why didn't she wonder whether there might be a Russian-style revolution here if something wasn't done? But she never did.
In other words, she didn't see that much of what FDR did was, in fact, a way to save capitalism.
Yes, that's right. she never saw that at all. But that's certainly something that one can see about what he did, that there was, it was a very dangerous time for the United States as well as the rest of the world, and we did avoid a revolution.
And I had to root for her, I guess I'd have to say, because here is a woman who was putting forward the rights of the individual, the superior individual, of course, the individual to do as they please. And I think that in that sense, you know, maybe if it had come from a man, it might be harder for me to take. But I had to reflect on, you know, this is so counter the training of women in general, myself included.
And women of that time, she was raised in a Victorian milieu. She came to the United States when women were, you know, they were not considered serious participants in the political process, at least. And she inserted herself right in there without being intimidated or cowed. And I admire her for that, too. I also think that if she had been a male writing what she wrote and advocating selfishness is a virtue and free market capitalism and this and that, she would not have been quite so. She was turned into a monster in the press. And in some ways she asked for it, but I'm not sure that it would have happened to her had she not been a woman moving against the stereotype of the nurturer and the, you know, the child raiser and so on and so forth. Wouldn't have been quite as shocking or as repugnant to people, I think.
You mentioned Nathaniel Brandon, her one of her acolytes. She gathered a coterie of disciples around her with him at its head. They called themselves somewhat ironically the Collective.
Yes.
And Alan Greenspan was one of them.
Yes, he was. There were thousands of acolytes of Ayn Rand in the United States in the 60s. All over the country there were college campus clubs and branches of objectivist clubs that met to study her work and listen to tapes of her speaking if they could get to New York to hear her lectures. Alan Greenspan was right on the spot in New York. He was married briefly. He's married now to Andrea Mitchell. He was married to another Mitchell for a couple of years. Her name was Joan Mitchell, and she brought him to meet Ayn Rand in the middle 50s when she was still working on Atlas Shrugged. And at first, Rand didn't have much, you know, she didn't think much of Alan Greenspan because he was so serious and solemn and he wore dark suits and he didn't say much. But as she got to know him a little bit better and as he began to respond to what he was hearing her read in Atlas Shrugged, she thought he was quite brilliant and she began to call him the sleeping giant. And he, in turn, said that many times he has said that she put the moral basis under capitalism for him, by which I think he meant that she taught him that it was not the least bad of a number of bad economic systems, but that it was a positive good in itself.
So what's your verdict about the impact of Ayn Rand on America, on our idea of ourselves?
She is read by so many young people who are looking for a model of independence, ambition, soaring visions of the future. She tells young people that they can do what they want to do and they don't have to pay attention to what anybody else says about it, that as long as they're productive and they're true to themselves, that they are innately doing it good for society. So I think she's added to the small group of, you know, rugged individualist fictional heroes we have in this country. Beyond that, I think that she's given a lot of arguments, a lot of strong argumentation to people who would argue that free market capitalism will take care of itself and that not owing anything to each other, we will still be fine. Hmm. And I don't necessarily believe that that's true.
That was Anne C. Heller talking with me in 2009 about her biography, Ayn Rand and the World She Made. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.